You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our studio guest today is crime writer Elizabeth Haynes. We'll also be hearing from book sculptor Justin Rowe and two more winning entries from the Rock Road Library Writing Competition. But firstly, hello, Elizabeth.
Hi, Lee. Hi.
We're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but Justin Rowe, he's a bookseller who does amazing book sculptors. He's not quite able to give up his job as a bookseller to be a book sculptor, but you're now a full-time novelist, aren't you?
I am, yes. I've fortunate to be able to be doing this full-time now.
Was there one particular moment at which you thought, you know what, I'm just going to do it?
I was pushed into it, really, because I loved my job. I worked for Kent Police. I've now moved up to Norfolk. But I absolutely loved it and loved the people I worked with. But the push came when there were severe cuts to policing budgets and a number of my colleagues were facing redundancy. And actually, I was too. I thought, this is the time. If I'm going to go, I don't want to take someone else's job and then leave in 3 months' time. And actually, I would have been one of the ones that was made redundant anyway, as it turned out. So I took a 2-year career break. And after that, there wasn't really any jobs that I could do to go back to. So I kind of was prompted into doing it, but really best thing I could have done, I think.
And does it feel different now?
It does. I mean, there are still days where I still feel like I'm on holiday, you know, and I should be getting on with something serious. But I love writing and I love being able to come out and meet people and talk about books. It's it gives me a fabulous opportunity to do that.
Does it put you under more pressure, though?
It does, actually, when you've got a nice meaty mortgage and, you know, family to responsibilities. But I think you have to close that off, really. You can't think about responsibility. Otherwise, it does put too much pressure on you and you dry up. So I have to just pretend I'm doing it for fun and hope for the best.
Well, as I say, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But we'll hear your first choice of music now, which is Elbow and Grounds for Divorce. Why this one?
This one links back to my second book, Revenge of the Tide, which is set on a converted barge on the River Medway. And my main character, Genevieve, is a former pole dancer from in London. And this is one of her pole dancing tracks.
I've been working on a cocktail called Grounds for Divorce.
Elbow and Grounds for Divorce, they're the first choice of music today from our studio guest on Bookmark, Elizabeth Haynes. Elizabeth is a former police intelligence analyst. Her first novel, Into the Darkest Corner, was published in 2011 and featured on Channel 4's TV Book Club. It was also selected as one of Amazon's UK Rising Stars and went on to win Amazon UK Best Book of 2011. Five more novels followed, the latest, Never Alone, published last year, described by one reviewer as a pulsating, sexy, slow-burn thriller with a brutal British winter as visceral as the pages themselves. That's a great comment, Liz, but I have to say, it's one with which I completely agree. It is a real page-turner of a novel. And reading it, it did strike me, how you do that? How do you put something on one page that makes people want to go, you know, not literally on one page, but in one chapter, that makes people want to read on?
It's a bit of an alchemy type process for me, really. And I think the only way I can describe it is I don't know what's going to happen when I write it. I always start off with just a little idea and see where it goes. So I don't plot, I don't plan at all, because otherwise I would get bored and not bother doing it. So the exciting bits are where I think I've thrown in, ooh, what if this happened? Let's see what happens next. And I just let the characters see how they would react, and generally they're quite terrified, and that usually works quite well. And then I have to get them out of the pickle, and so it goes on, and the boring bits kind of get cut out, which helps to keep the exciting bits in.
You don't plot. That's extraordinary.
Yes.
So you have no idea when you start what on earth is going to happen, or do you have a vague shape in your head?
Occasionally I'll have a vague idea of where I'm heading to, but generally speaking, I try and avoid thinking about it too much before I write it. I always write in November for National Novel Writing Month, so I write at speed. I write 50,000 words in 30 days, often more if I can. And the result of that is that you can't stop to think about things too much, you just have to plough on. Unfortunately, the downside of it, and this is where I admire plotters and wish I was one, is of course it takes a phenomenal amount of editing to make it work, because I'm always digging massive plot holes and struggling to get out of them. So it's not for everybody, but it works for me.
And you mentioned National Novel Writing Month there, NaNoWriMo. That was kind of what got you started in the first place, wasn't it?
I first discovered National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo.org is the website, and a friend of mine recommended it to me in October 2005, and I thought, this is the excuse I've been waiting for, because I've always written and never really managed to finish anything or do anything at great length. So to have just 30 days where writing can take a priority and everything else can just wait was great for me. I mean, I was working full time. I had a very young son at the time as well. And actually, to just prioritise writing for a month was great. And all of my books are written in November now. I don't know any other way of doing it. So I need that momentum and that excitement to really be able to get on with it and finish something.
And you mentioned your job there. You worked as an intelligence analyst. What is one, an intelligence analyst?
It's a civilian role, so I wasn't a police officer, but the role is basically focused on using crime data and intelligence to best direct police resources. So it's kind of designed to replace the old copper's gut instinct from back in the day, where a beat officer really knew his territory and knew who all the naughty people were and what they were likely to be doing. These days, police officers are incredibly busy and moving around an awful lot as well. So using actual data to predict where crimes might happen or where the hotspots are is an analyst job behind a nice spreadsheet, trying to advise people where they need to go to prevent crime.
And I'm guessing you use some of that knowledge and that experience in your work.
Yeah, it's more than just that. I mean, although I am trying to redress the balance of the fact that analysts aren't mentioned in crime dramas or on TV very much. So all of my books have got an analyst somewhere in them, hidden sometimes, but the police procedurals definitely do. The analyst quite often is the background person who spots the missing bit of information that will unravel the whole case, as is quite true in real life. It's more about the banter, really, and the police family and the sense of community that you get working for the police, which is truly wonderful. And I don't think people really, civilians who don't have an involvement with the police on a day-to-day basis, really get a sense of that, of how important it is to be part of that family.
So given your job and given that you liked writing, was it always inevitable that this was going to be the genre you fall in? Were you a fan of this genre?
Yes. Funnily enough, before I joined the police, I used to write romance. Didn't really get very far with that, but I always read crime and I always admired crime writers and wanted to be a part of that world, but never felt I had the necessary qualification to do it. So funnily enough, when I applied for my first job with the police, which was working at Kent Police College as a course coordination supervisor, there was a little voice in the back of my mind that said, you know what, you could write crime now. And it almost felt like an extra bonus of getting that job, really, was that I was now qualified. to write crime.
And is that how you describe yourself as a crime writer? Because it's like your psychological thriller. Not all of them have a police detective who's solving a crime.
No, I think I suppose I am a crime writer. It's definitely the best genre to be in, I think. I've met writers from other genres, and crime writers are generally a very fun, loving, friendly bunch. So yeah, psychological thrillers, cozies, they all come under the same banner. So at the moment, I'm working on a historical crime thriller. So I like to feel that I'm still in that group of people.
Because it is quite a busy marketplace, isn't it? So I guess when you go into it, you have to feel that you can do something a little bit different.
I think you just have to write the book you want to write, and wherever it falls, the marketing is a whole different kettle of fish, really. Just the important thing, I think, is to write the book that's inside you and not try to worry about what might happen after publication. But yes, it is a very busy market, and luckily there's space for me and there's space for a few more people. So anyone out there who wants to write, I would definitely say give it a go.
And have you always written since you were young?
Yes, always. I've kept a diary since I was 11, and I used to write short stories in reporters' notebooks and hand them around the playground, never dreaming that one day I would be an actual writer. That was something that happens to other people, I think.
Well, let's hear from some more young writers now. We'll come back and chat to you further, Elizabeth. But we're now going to hear two more winning entries from the Rock Road Library Creative Writing Competition. The theme was location as inspiration, and entrants were asked to write a poem, short story or piece of prose about somewhere in Cambridge. We've a crime story in your honour, Elizabeth. The book With the Hidden Code by Amelia Dale was a runner-up in the 7 to 11-year-old category. But we'll start with Cambridge. What do you think of when you hear that word by Natty Huckle, which was a runner-up in the 12 to 16-year-old category?
Cambridge. What do you think of when you hear that word? Children might think of new toys. Teenagers might think of shopping. Students might think of university. New parents might think of childcare essentials. House owners might think of decoration. Photographers might think of beauty. And businessmen might think of money. I don't think of any of them when I hear the word Cambridge. I think of the cold. The cold that strikes as early as autumn. I think of the icy wind that whips around my ankles and slaps my cheek with a harsh smirk. I think of the people who walk past every day, laden with numerous shopping bags, who can afford to wear warm garments that banish the cold and dismiss the icy breath that descended from the darkened clouds. I am a homeless person. That's what I'm normally referred to as. It's the harsher names that hurt the most, the ones that slip from people's mouths and penetrate my insides like ice, colder than any I've ever felt before. Tramp. Vagabond. Vagrant. Beggar. Dosser. Hobo. Waste of space. People walk past and pretend I don't exist. It's like they choose not to see me. It's that or a bitter, cruel stare. Sometimes, if people are kind enough, they leave a few pennies on my blanket and hurry off without a word. Occasionally, generous individuals go into a nearby convenience store and buy me a tepid coffee and a sandwich. No one leaves more than that, though. The best thing I ever found or received was a £10 note that was drenched in grime and down a drain. It's as if people don't trust me. They think I will most likely waste it on drugs or alcohol. But I would never do that. I wish they could see the real me. I sit outside the entrance to a cosmetic store, situated in a part of town teeming with tourists. From there, I can see part of King's College. In the summer, the lush trees near the college show off their beauty, and they become the most lavish of greens, a deep, rich green that defines summer. However, in the winter, it looks like a completely different place. The branches of the trees reach out to me like gnarled fingers in a tangled web of confusion. Frost clings to the trees and sinister sensations envelop me. Despite the evil surroundings that sometimes overwhelm me, my dream is to go to King's College one day.
On the glistening morning of 1st of December 1932, Agatha Peabody, the librarian at King's College, Cambridge, placed the notice that everyone eagerly awaited. The Christmas ball was announced. Agatha strolled back to her desk, happily relaxed into her chair, and looked up at the impressive shelf of books, a set of handsome specimens, perfectly arranged behind the shining glass door and bound in leather with gold lettering on the spine. They were Agatha's favourite books, the rare ones which she cherished, and the most valuable. They were a fine selection of first editions written by famous authors, collected and owned by King's College. Her eyes wandered along the prized shelf as she smiled contentedly, until she suddenly noticed the small, ominous gap. Agatha narrowed her focus on the gap, panicking. She started to shake as she realised a book was missing. Agatha jumped up, unlocked the glass door, pulled the books out, went through every book on the shelf and confirmed the unthinkable suspicion that the first edition of Hamlet by William Shakespeare had been stolen. She ran to the telephone on her desk and called the police. Agatha became very agitated, pacing around, scanning shelves and looking everywhere. She was still rushing around when the detectives burst in through the door. William Philpot, Ramsay Cartwright and Margot Makepeace marched in, holding notepads and with magnifying glasses at the ready. Inspector Philpot was the first to speak. He asked Agatha to give a precise account of what had happened and list all visitors to the library since she last saw the book. Cartwright, a student detective, rapidly took notes, while Makepeace checked all door locks. It did not appear that anyone had broken in. The mystery person must have known where the keys were kept, and as Agatha spent every hour of the day in the library, it was likely that the book was stolen during the night. The detectives used their magnifying glasses to look for evidence, took fingerprints from the crime scene, and decided to monitor the people coming in and out of the library. Maybe someone would secretly sneak the book back in, and if that happened, they would catch that person. As the afternoon light faded, the detectives left and told Agatha to lock the door and go home. She pretended to agree, but as soon as they were gone, she took her coat off and settled down for the night. She could not possibly leave the library under these circumstances. She felt like being a detective herself, and secretly thought that she could do a far better job than Philpot, Cartwright and Makepeace, who, after all, did not care nearly as deeply as she did. She was attached to the treasured books and could not rest until the mystery was solved. As the moonlight shone through the window, Agatha wriggled and stirred in her chair. The silence was broken by the sound of leaves outside blowing in the wintry night. She sensed someone outside. Agatha tiptoed to the window, approaching it from the side so she could not be seen. She peeped out and saw them. The famous group called the Night Climbers, who were known for climbing the ancient buildings of Cambridge, but only at night. There they were in front of her, never seen by anyone before, but now scaling up the magnificent King's College Chapel. She was stunned, but then thought about whether they were involved in taking the book. Agatha watched from the safety of the locked library. To her amazement, they climbed to the top of one of the spires and back down with no mistake. They then started approaching the library building. Agatha started thinking hard, her eyes darting around, thoughts whizzing through her head. She suddenly had an idea and took a much less valuable book and placed it carefully behind the glass door of the shelf where the first editions were held. She was certain they would be back for more. All she had to do now was call Inspector Philpot, ask him to cycle to the library, let him in quietly, and wait. Inspector Philpot arrived and sat in wait. The Night Climbers, as Agatha predicted, had a key to the library. They let themselves in, moved towards the shelf where the highly valuable books were stored, and, to her amazement, Cartwright was one of them. How could this be? Cartwright came to try and solve the crime, and instead he was in the middle of it. As she discreetly moved towards the bookshelf where she had placed the trap, the night climbers had seen Philpott, and suddenly there was a blood-curdling scream. Philpott lay on the library carpet, drowned in his own blood. Agatha ran from the library, down the corridor, stopping briefly to pick up a notebook which had been dropped, and escaped, overcome by the horrors of what she had just witnessed. The sun rose the next morning, and Agatha turned to the notebook, wondering if this had any significance. She flipped through the pages, realising it was Cartwright's notebook. At the back, it said, "Find code on back of first edition Hamlet to lead to information on escape routes for night climbers. You must achieve 3 night climbs and successful escapes to be a master night climber." Agatha gasped. She had just solved the mystery herself. The night climbers wanted the book to find a code. She pieced together the sequence of events. Cartwright was a fake detective posing as support to Philpott, but secretly obtaining vital information about the library in order to help his group of night climbers. As Christmas approached, the night of the ball arrived. People gathered in beautiful gowns and suits. As they danced late into the night, Agatha smiled at knowing her mystery was solved. But did Cartwright return to replace Hamlet, or to take another prize book containing another code for the next mysterious night climb?
And the book with the hidden code by Amelia Dale was read by Sandra Burney. And Cambridge, What Do You Think Of When You Hear That Word by Natty Huckle was read by Andrew Shepherd. You were enjoying those, Elizabeth.
I was really enjoying them. What a pair of talented writers they were. They're fantastic.
Aren't they? And the book with the hidden code, it had all the elements that you need for
it
a mystery and a crime.
It did. It had a gasp out loud twist there as well. I was, you know, on the edge of my seat listening to it.
So what elements do you need for a crime thriller? Are the common things that occur all the way through?
Oh, goodness, that's a really tricky question. I think these days, I mean, the crime is sort of a focus of it, but in these days of psychological thrillers, actually, quite often the crime is almost subsequent to the behaviour of the characters who experience it, and it's more about the feelings of and the relationships involved as well. So traditional police procedurals, you know, you get a body and a detective and a twist and hopefully a resolution at the ending, but it's often more complicated than that.
And I notice you often tell from multiple perspectives.
Yeah.
You'll look at the same scene from the eyes of two different characters or tell the story from two different ways. Why does that appeal to you?
I'm really interested in different ways of telling a story, and I was quite influenced really by the early books of Nikki French, also a local couple of authors actually, who one of my favourite authors, I suppose, is Nikki French, and they always have a different way of telling each story. So I've always experimented with different timelines or different perspectives, and in my police procedurals as well, I include a lot of documents as well. So there's intelligence reports, forensic reports, witness statements, and things alongside the text. And I think it's just an interesting way, and often you have to try several ways when you're writing it to find the best way of telling the story, the most intriguing way.
And in Never Alone, one of the perspectives is told in the second person singular,
yeah.
So you, mm-hmm. which is notoriously hard to write.
Yeah, and I don't know why I came up with that. It was the voice of Aidan is told in the second person, and it just seemed to be. It seemed to make him scarier to do it like that. I don't know why, because, you know, without giving anything away, he's a very charming, sensible, nice man at the start of the book. And to hear his innermost thoughts and to be right there looking out of his eyes, in a way, in the book is quite a creepy thing, I think.
He has secrets.
Everybody has secrets.
Everybody. Well, let's go to some music now. A Peaceful World by John Mellencamp. Why this one?
I've been a fan of John Mellencamp since about 1985, since a German exchange visit where a friend introduced me to him. And this is one of his later ones. I love it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today on Bookmark, crime writer Elizabeth Haynes. Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you about the women in your novels who are often centre. I like these women. They're good, earthy women.
Yes.
You know, they enjoy a drink. They enjoy sex. They enjoy having a good time. Is that a deliberate choice?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe, I hesitate to say it, maybe they're all a reflection of me. I'm not sure. I don't drink very much, I have to say, but I have had my party days back in the distant past, and I think they're probably a reflection of the women that I have been, or the women I would like to be, maybe.
I like them just because they're rounded. You know, they're not, there's often in crime, there's this woman as victim who's very sweet and very nice and gets preyed upon. It's not to say bad things don't happen to these women, but they're very robust.
I find it difficult reading books where the woman is just a victim and has no other role to play. And I think with any book you read, your characters, you have to believe that they have a life outside the book and that their life will continue onwards after you've turned the last page. But for me as well, I don't like books where the woman requires rescuing and is unable to find a way out of her dilemma by herself without a man or another person coming to rescue her. So I think you put women in very dangerous situations in these books. I do in particular. But I like to believe that they have the resources that they need, if they can only find them, to get them out of whatever pickle they're in.
And the action sequences that often occur in your book, probably at the climax of the book, they really are page turners. How do you write those? Is that a whole splurge of words that you go back and carefully edit? Because there's a real pace to them.
Funnily enough, thinking particularly of Never Alone, there's the last third of the book really is a kind of almost like that fabulous Donald Sutherland film, The Eye of the Needle, which I loved, where there's this unrelenting struggle against the weather to try and get away from something awful. And that really inspired me for this book. And that last third where the battle is really on, the danger is identified and you have to get away, that didn't need a lot of editing, actually. I did write that all in one go. And it's when you're writing at pace like I do, you get that momentum built up and you've what am I going to do next, you know, as a writer, but also for the characters. And that helps itself, really, I think.
And the location is as much of a character, particularly in that book, that Yorkshire winter. I'm as a Yorkshire lass myself. I can say that you depicted it very well. How did you research that?
Well, funnily enough, the whole idea for the book came from browsing on Rightmove. You know, I think a lot of writers do this and spend a lot of time looking at houses. We were at that time thinking of moving, and I found this house hunkered down into the Yorkshire hillside, a good 2 miles away from other civilization, but with a lovely view over the valley. And it was a lovely house. It had a fabulous bathroom with a wonderful clawfoot roll top bath right by a massive window with no curtains. And I remember thinking how peculiar it was to have no curtains or no frosted glass in your bathroom, and then realizing that outside there was nothing but hillside and sheep to look at you having a bath. And then I found myself thinking, but what if there was someone outside watching you have a bath? And there we are, there's my whole story. The only element that was missing really was the snow, which I find is often used as a device, and none more so than in my book, because when it snows there is no escape. You know, mobile phone signals are down, landline signals are down, there's no way you can get out or go anywhere. So it's the ultimate locked room setting, really.
But it's a metaphor as well in this case for loneliness and for secrets being hidden.
Yes. And you've got to wonder about somebody actually choosing to live in a place where they can be that cut off and isolating themselves in a way, which is possibly why we didn't end up moving to that particular house or Yorkshire.
And it is a sexy book. There are sex scenes in it, and again, notoriously difficult to write. How did you find those?
Yes, brace yourselves, people, I'm afraid. I don't know. I think the sex scenes in Never Alone come out of the job of one of the characters, and that was just such an intriguing thing for me to write about. And this man is a sensual masseur, so he basically spends his time allowing women to find their own sexuality again when perhaps they've lost it. So there's elements at play here about sex over the age of 40, heaven forbid, maintaining your sexuality and being comfortable with it. Of course, not everything goes to plan in my books, as always, but one thing that I think is definitely the case is the main character is not being punished for her sexuality. She's allowed to have a sexual relationship with whoever she wants, and that's something I find quite important to write about.
Is it? I mean, when you start, do you think, I've got these themes, I want to cover these, or do they emerge as you're writing?
Sometimes they emerge, but, you know, I quite like writing about sex. It's it's entertaining. and again, it's if you're writing in November for National Novel Writing Month, those scenes are quite fast and easy to write and get you on to the next exciting, scary bit. So that's the function they serve as well.
Well, and you keep people second guessing. You talk about scary bits. You do keep people second guessing. How do you do that? You're always aware when you're writing, I guess, what the reader might be thinking, and sometimes you want them to think that, and sometimes you want to think something.
Not at all. No, I'm always quite surprised when I get my first feedback from people, and they say, "Gosh, I really thought that this was going to happen," or "I really thought that person was going to turn out to be this person." You know, so I don't know how it happens, but there are always things people find in my books that I didn't realise were there, and it's always a bonus, and later on I can say, oh yes, that was entirely intentional.
Oh, that must be quite exciting, because it's a discovery for you.
It is, yeah. And my wonderful copy editor Linda, when she'd finished working on Never Alone, she told me it was about vulnerable men and fatherless sons, and it totally is, but I hadn't seen that when I was writing it.
Well, we'll come back to you for a little more chat. We're going to take a sidestep now, I suppose. Justin Rowe works for Cambridge University Press as an academic bookseller, but his book-based art has become famous around the world. In 2013, he had a solo exhibition at the British Academy as part of their Literature Week. And you can often see his work in window displays of the CUP bookshop on Market Square in Cambridge, as well as online. But when I met Justin to chat, we started by trying to define his work. Justin, what is the name of the craft that you follow, really?
I call it book sculpture, or it could be book art. It's making paper sculptures out of books, basically.
And how did you first get into that?
I work in a bookshop in Cambridge, and the first one I ever did was 2010. I had to make a window display for Christmas, and I didn't know what to do. I'd done various things in the years previously, and this year I had no idea what to do. And my wife showed me something in, I think it was a Waitrose magazine or something like that. There was some paper trees in the background of an article. And she said, well, why don't you try doing something like that? And I went, OK. So I had to go and I cut out a paper tree, put the trees into some big books and put them in the window. And the response was fairly instant, of people gathering around saying, oh, this is really great, and that kind of thing. So that's how it started.
And they are beautiful. And for people who haven't seen them, they're sculptures out of books. Are they actually out of the books that they seem to arise from?
Some of them, they're completely made out of the same book. Other times I make things and then insert them into. So I'll make, like, I cut out a delicate tree from another piece of paper and then put it in. Try and make it look like it's seamlessly growing out of the tree, out of the book, sorry.
And where do you get the books from?
I get them from junk shops mainly. I try and get them as cheaply as possible because it really doesn't matter what they look like for what I do with them. In fact, the more battered and antique they look, the better for me, because it lends a quality to the finished thing. So, yeah, I go out of my way to try and to avoid any books that any actual reader would want to use.
I was going to say, because some people think books are sacred, they might think what you're doing is blasphemy almost.
Some people do get very upset and then explain, no, these books that would just be in landfill otherwise. So I feel like I'm giving them a new life rather than wasting them.
And they vary in size. How long, on average, does it take you?
It can vary enormously. Probably the very quickest ones take about 4 hours. They're ones where I find a nice image in a book and I cut the pages to make waves. And so they're the ones that tend to take the least amount of time to actually make, but the longest amount of time to find a usable book. Whereas other ones with delicate trees, that kind of thing, they can take 2 weeks, something like that. 3 weeks for a big, really elaborate one.
And lots of them have trees. They're popular, are they?
They're popular, and they're popular with me. I really like doing the trees. So they're, yeah, very organic, and I do them completely freehand. So I don't do any planning of the trees before. I just start cutting of a scalpel and just see where they go.
So you must have had an artistic background to be able to adjust so readily to this.
I have an artistic background. I went to art school, the Norwich School of Art and Design, in the 90s, but I didn't do anything like this at all. I did video installation art, which is kind of as far opposite on the spectrum as you can get.
And these are creative expressions as well, aren't they? As well as making beautiful sculptures, you are actually making a creative statement.
Yes, I think so, yes. I mean, what I try to do is I try to capture the feeling of reading the book in one snapshot image. So instead of reading the book recently, I prefer it if it's a book that I've read a long time ago, and then the memory is more vague, and then I can put that into the finished thing.
So talk us maybe through a few of them, maybe through one or two. You're saying at the moment you're thinking a lot about Pride and Prejudice.
Pride and Prejudice is one I've done recently, and again, a book I read a very long time ago, probably 25 or more years ago. And I came across a copy of the book that had an illustration. That spoke to me instantly, obviously. So then I wanted to kind of surround that with sort of springtime trees. It just gave me the sense of the book somehow.
And what other ones have you done?
I've done several different ones of the Narnia books, particularly The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, which feature the lamppost. And the lamppost is illuminated with an LED, and they just have a very sort of magical quality, and I surround them with sort of spiky, wintry trees, and has the little figure of Mr. Tumnus and Lucy in it. That seems to be the one that people love the best, and it could be because it's a favourite childhood story or something like that.
This is very delicate work, isn't it?
It is, yes, yes, yes. I'm not sure it's great for my eyesight, but it's quite relaxing as well. It doesn't take up much space and it doesn't make much mess, so I can do it anywhere. So, it's a relaxing thing to do, really.
And apart from books, obviously, what other tools do you need?
All I use is a scalpel. It's a very small scalpel. It's got a rotating blade, so I can do tight curves and that kind of thing easily. And glue, and that's it, really. I mean, a little bit of electronics if it's got lighting. Occasionally use some gold leaf or something like that, but mostly paper, knife, glue, that's it.
From that initial display in the Cambridge University Press bookshop, they've gone all over the world since then, haven't they?
They have, yes, yes. I've sent some to Spain, sent several to America. I've had inquiries from Australia. Oh, and Finland. I did a big commission for a lady in Finland as well. So, it's really spread quite remarkably.
And is this how you earn your living?
Sadly not. No, it's very difficult to make a full-time living from being an artist. But it's a nice sideline.
And you do sell some?
I do, yes, I absolutely do. I mostly sell commissions, in fact, where people come to me and they say, oh, I really love this story, can you make a version of that for me? And I usually can, and so in some ways that's better for me. They've brought me the idea already.
And what are you working on at the moment?
At the moment, I've just finished one of The Pilgrim's Progress, and I'm thinking about starting A Wizard of Oz, which would have an illuminated Emerald City in it.
And are you ever going to do one on a big scale? And some of the ones you do are quite big, but is it something that lends itself to scale?
I tried scaling it up for a window display, make it really big to completely fill the window. In some ways it was successful, but in other ways I think it lost some of the magic somehow, making it bigger. They really lend themselves to people crouching around them and trying to lose themselves in the story.
And are there other people doing this kind of work?
There are. When I very first started, I think there were one or two in the world, and it seems to have grown a bit since then. And, yeah, it's probably 10, 20, something like that.
And people can buy your work online?
They can, yes. I have a website, which is daysfalllikeleaves.com, which has all my contact details on it. And I also have an Etsy shop where I sell cards and prints and that kind of thing.
That was Justin Rowe there. And just to repeat that website address, it's daysfalllikeleaves.com. We were looking at some of his work, Elizabeth, before we came on air, weren't we? It's beautiful.
We were. It's amazing, incredible attention to detail. It must be amazing to see one in real life, I think.
Must have to have incredible patience to do that. Well, we've been talking so far. We haven't mentioned Detective Inspector Louisa Smith.
Yes.
Who's one of your continuous characters. Will we be following her through many books?
Yes, I've got there's two already. Under a Silent Moon is the first, and Behind Closed Doors is the second. And I'm about 80,000 words into the third book in the series, so hopefully that will be along before too much longer. But writing a police procedural usually is with one detective, but I have to say with mine it's more about the team, as is the case in a real detective investigation, real murder investigation. There it's all about the teamwork, and there won't be just one person doing the interviewing and everything. So this is another reason why I write the multiple perspectives, particularly in those books, so you get a sense of the other people who are also working on the investigation and on the other side. Without giving too much away, at the end of the next book she's going to go on maternity leave, so then there will be another detective in charge of the investigation, and hopefully a little bit down the line she'll come back baby in tow and carry on.
And where did she come from?
Funnily enough, a lot of my former police colleagues were really intrigued by these books and always wanting to know if they were in them, and they all are, although they don't recognise themselves, which is quite interesting. And Louisa is an amalgamation of two people I worked with, a senior detective and a civilian, who were both really strong, inspirational women, and I kind of blended them together to create Louisa.
And do you know where she's going? I mean, you've mentioned maternity leave. Do you know what happens to her after that? Do you know her story?
A little bit, yes. I mean, the key thing with a series character, I think, is the relationships with the team members and with their private relationships as well. And I have a sense of where she's going with that. But in terms of what the next crime she's going to face is, that's not quite in my head yet.
And I suppose as a writer, it gives you two stories to think about, really, not just the crime that she's investigating, but her personal story and how she's relating to that.
Yes, and it's important not to lose sight of what the exciting thing for the reader is, because while I'm excited to know how she's getting on with her partner and how she's dealing with maternity leave and everything else, actually that's probably not what the reader wants to hear about. So it's interesting when you get feedback on these books, how many people love her and how many people are frustrated by her and the other long-standing series characters as well.
So that's the book you're writing at the moment. You say you're 80,000 words in.
Yeah, I'm kind of working on five different ones at the moment.
Five?
I'm not very good at finishing things, so I tend to hop from one to the other, but all of them have started in November. So it's the key to it is carrying on after November until you've actually written the end is a useful tip for anyone else who's going to tackle it.
How do you hold all those five different books in your head, all those characters and plot twists and turns?
I think it stops me getting bored with any of them, really. And when I get stuck with one, then I can always move on to another one for a little while, and then the ideas crystallise, so I work out where I need to go back to with the first book. So,
and you work with Myriad Editions, a small publisher who punch way above their weight.
They are fabulous. They are. I'm so lucky to be published by Myriad and Sphere as well, who publish the procedurals. But to have one great publisher is brilliant, but to have two is awesome. And Myriad in particular are they're very brave in what they publish and very, very talented in spotting excellent books. So I can highly recommend them.
And you talked about your own reading earlier, Nikki French. Are there other books that you keep coming back to?
Yeah, I read a lot of crime, but what I do tend to find is I'm reading a lot of the latest books that come out. So there are fabulous books all around. I mean, there's one coming out this week, actually, He Said, She Said by Erin Kelly, which I absolutely loved. Last year, The Darkest Secret by Alex Marwood was absolutely fantastic. And the new Sophie Hannah that's coming out in August that I've just finished is awesome too, called Did You See Melody? So there's just three that I've absolutely loved recently. But if you give me another 5 minutes, I'll give you another 10.
Well, this is nice because you're talking about books that haven't come out yet. You get sneak previews.
I do. It's one of the privileges of being a writer is I get to see books often before they're released to the general public. And that feels like a terrific privilege.
And what are you reading at the moment?
I am, now let me think. I have just finished reading Ragnar Jonasson's Rupture, which is a book I'm reading for Crime Fest, which is taking place in May, and I'm a participating moderator. So I'm reading the books that the people that are on my panel. And it's a fantastic locked room type mystery set in an Icelandic fjord. So proper Scandi noir, but it feels like, as a lot of the reviewers have said, it feels like a golden age detective fiction. And if you enjoyed the TV series that was on last year called Trapped, which I did, it's absolutely perfect for you. I highly recommend that one too.
Are you a fan of the Scandi noir, are you?
I don't read that many of them. I know some of my friends will only read Scandi noir now, but I think other than Stieg Larsson, which I read a few years ago, this is probably the first one I've read. And I loved it. So, yeah, I highly recommend it.
It's interesting how certain niches and avenues still seem to be developing within this genre. You think, oh, that's it. And then suddenly, five, 10 years ago, yeah, we get Scandi noir.
Well, also, I'm quite jealous of Sophie Hannah's one that I mentioned a while ago, because she seems to have developed spa noir, which I so wish I'd thought of. Her book is set in a five-star spa resort in Arizona, which is a perfect setting for a thriller, and of course brilliant for research.
I was going to say a perfect place to research, yes. Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Elizabeth. We've been talking about Never Alone, which has been published by Myriad Editions. Just a heads up, the next bookmark is a month away due to schedule changes, and our studio guest then will be novelist Rosie Thornton. We'll also hear from short story writer, poet and winner of the Words and Women Writing Competition, Melissa Fu, and we'll have more winners and runners-up from the Rock Road Library Writing Competition. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, so Elizabeth, which is Worried About by Lissy. Why this one?
There's a line in it towards the end: the last 4 years of my life, I've thought about you pretty much every 15 seconds, which is, if I could have had an epigram for Never Alone, it would have been that.
I'm too worried about what you're doing. Are you worried about what I'm doing too? What you're doing to me? Why can't you see? I'm too worried about what you're doing. Are you worried about what I'm doing too? Or what you're doing to me? Wanna be free? And who